history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that you've probably never heard before that you're going to be thankful you did hear by the time we're done. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Chula Vista, California with 93-year-old Dr. Robert Thomas. I'm going to take the liberty of calling him Bob because I'm guessing that's what they called him growing up in Los Angeles many, many years ago. He's going to take us on quite a journey today through the war in Europe during World War II. There's some mystery, some intrigue, maybe even some confused history that he's going to try to sort out for us by the time we're done. But Bob, let's start out. Your childhood, you had a couple brothers and a sister. Growing up in Southern California, what was that like?
It was wonderful. I can remember living in Long Beach, going through junior high school, graduating from Woodrow Wilson High School.
What were the things you did as a kid? And I know you spent 40 years as an optometrist. Were you thinking as a kid, hey, I'm going to be an eye doctor someday?
When I returned from the military, I didn't know what direction to go. I got a job at a mortuary, strange as it may seem. And when I worked at the mortuary, I was able to have a place to stay. I found out that I'd like to get some degree, and then I went on and I became an optometrist in 1959.
Well, here's what I'm wondering. So that's what you ended up doing. That's after you make it home from the war and after you work at the mortuary. What about when you were a kid? What were your dreams or ambitions when you were a boy?
I had wonderful parents, and I had a great time in grammar school. As far as high school, I was involved in sports and great time there. When I was in high school, the worst thing we ever did was ditch class. But while I was in high school, I held a record of rope climbing with a long, long rope. I don't know, maybe 30 or 40 feet. At that time, you don't use your legs. You just arm it. Mm-hmm. And I was up and down before you could believe it. I think I still, after all these years, hold a record at the Woodrow Wilson High School in rope climbing. So I had a good childhood, and I had a lot of buddies. When I was in junior high school, I got a job at a market right on the street. The cashier was there at the register and the stand, and I was just behind her, and I was in the butcher shop, which was closed on that day. I was filling paper sacks full of sugar. Uh-huh. That was my job. And then all of a sudden, a car pulls up at the curb just 10 feet, 20 feet away. And a guy comes in, and he says, "Give me your money," to the cashier. And she's putting the money on the stand. And then he says, "You see that guy?" And there was another guy in the car he just got out of. He was sticking a double-barrel shotgun out. He says, "You see that shotgun there?" He says, "Do you have any money?" And I says, "No, I don't have any money, only the cashier." So he goes back to the cashier, and she puts the money out on the counter and everything. And then he comes over to me, and then he says, "Kid, give me something to put my money in." All I had was those small sugar bakes, and I plopped them up there. And he says, "Don't you have anything bigger?" "No." I says, "No." So I did give him, I don't know, it's a stack of paper sacks. And so he grabbed it, put the money in, and gone.
Well, that'll get your attention. And I think there was something else that got your attention. If I do the math, you must have been 15 years old when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. What do you remember about December 7th, 1941?
Headlines everywhere. Everybody talking about it. And no one really was aware of the severity of the whole situation. But that was the start of Americanism, I think.
How did you see things change after that? How did your life change?
I was wounded in village fighting. I was blown off of a hill by German rockets called Screaming Mimis. And I ended up in an evac center, which happened to be a palace, and with crystal chandeliers. They didn't have evac centers before I was there, and so the lieutenants, they took over a castle. So anyway, as I lay in a stretcher on the floor, I was very, very nauseated. I looked up at the ceiling, and I could see the crystal chandelier rotating round and round and round. I was bleeding from both ears, and I couldn't hear anything, and it was not a good time. So from evac center to a hospital, from a hospital to a tent, and the tent was rehab. And I was alone in this tent, and an officer from my 90th Infantry Division came into the tent, and he says, "Private," he says, "I need you." And he says, "I want you to ride with me and check out some of the villages." So he took me to his Harley Davidson motorcycle. I was shotgun. I took the place as a shotgun. And he handed me a .45 grease gun. So I hopped on and away we went. And by coincidence, we did find a village that was different from all the others. And this village had a tall smokestack and no smoke coming out of it. And so we decided to investigate, the lieutenant and I. And so we finally went down to the salt mine, and everybody was sticking white flags out. So we pulled the cycle up to the gate. About 8 or 10 men in long white coats came and just caused a ruckus at the gate. And the lieutenant says, "Who's in charge?" And one of the guys in the white coats, and they had automatic weapons hidden underneath their white coats. And so, "Who's in charge?" And the man pointed to a tall house with a bay window sticking out in the front across the street. So anyway, we went across the street, and the kind lady took us upstairs to a room, opened a door for us, and we went in the door, and she closed the door. The room was empty, so we stood there for a couple of minutes while the curtains in the bay window pulled back, exposing a civilian. He said he was the mine director. And so the lieutenant said, "We want to inspect the mine." So we went across the street. I went through the gate, and the 10 long white-coated guys rushed the gate, and the mine director waved them off, and we went in and saw the lab inside with all of the lab work that they do in a situation like that. And as we're touring the lab, I stopped by a kiln. The mine director looked at me, and he walked over, and he opened up the microwave-sized kiln, and there were some tobacco leaves in there. And he says, "Für mein Rauchen," for my smoking. And then we went down to the elevator. And as I recall, before the elevator, there were parts of another aircraft, and I didn't recognize any of the parts, so it must have been maybe one of the V-1 or V-2 rockets. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so he says, "I'm sorry, but I can't take you down to the mine. We don't have any steam in the boilers, so, and then we can't use the elevators." So he said, "Come back tomorrow, and I'll take you down." So on that, I hopped on the cycle and back, shotgun, and we rode off. Then we went through the canyons and so on. Then we stopped and we discussed the situation. The lieutenant says, "Let's go back now," about an hour later when we left. And he said, "We'll give them time to get the boilers up and see what it is." Because he says, "There's a lot of white flags that were coming in, showing us when we went in." He says, "They must have thought we were the advanced scouts of a large American force. Otherwise, they would have killed us for sure."
Because there were a lot more of them than there were of you.
We had no chance.
It was two of you.
That's the two of us. And eventually, we did go down the salt mines to the shaft, down to the bottom. And that's when both of us, found the German village, Ransbach, and its salt mine. And ultimately, we went down, and I found all sorts of things. I took with me 2 16th century, 500-year-old legal books, one in German and one in Latin. And also in that Ransbach, I found thousands of opera costumes, which later was sent to all the major opera houses in Europe and the United States.
So you're an 18-year-old kid, and you're in this mine. You don't know how much danger you're in, and then you're seeing all these things that probably don't have an obvious explanation. And so what you learned eventually was that those books and other books like them and opera costumes, that they were sent to the salt mine for safekeeping because there was so much bombing going on, all these priceless artifacts would have been lost. So they were put there for safekeeping. You found them. You held on to those books for quite a long time, but you don't have them anymore. What happened?
I contacted the National Archives to see if they could help me. I contacted the lead archivist, Greg Bradshaw, and he was interested, particularly when I told him I have the books. We went back and forth email for months and months and months.
And so what you learned eventually was that those books and other books like them and opera costumes, that they were sent to the salt mine for safekeeping because there was so much bombing going on, all these priceless artifacts would have been lost. So they were put there for safekeeping. You found them. You had them for decades. You talk to the archives and they say, we'll try to get them back to where they belong. And they are now back in Germany?
Yes. I returned them to Klaus Schiroff, German ambassador. There was a ceremony for me to give the books back. When I gave the books back to the ambassador, he says, Bob, when you two left the salt mine, the people in Ransbach had been walking around in rags for years. They wanted and needed new clothes. Since you two left, there's no one to guard the entrance. So the villagers knew that the Germans had stored all kinds of things down in the salt mine. So they decided to go down. They climbed down wooden ladders because the elevators were not working, no steam in the boilers. But they did climb down into the mine, 2,500 feet, and found the opera costumes. When they found the opera costumes, they carried them back up to their villages. Soon, all the other villagers sent out warnings to all the villages. Do not go to the village of Ransbach. They have the strangest people walking around in the weirdest clothes. I thank the laughing ambassador. One thing I should tell you, and that is, I went overseas with 17,000 of us on the Queen Mary, and ultimately I ended up alone in Metz, France. The train dropped me off, and I walked down this tunnel, dark tunnel. You could see a light at the far end. And as I'm walking down the tunnel, I can hear my boots hit the stone floor. A voice behind me says, can I help you, sir? And I turn my head around, and here was this 6'4" black man with a turban on his head. I was so frightened because I didn't hear any sounds when he approached me from the rear that I just stood there. So he took my bags and led me to the light at the end of the tunnel. And so when I went into the end of the tunnel, it led into this big open space bordered by stone walls and buildings. It was dark now. You could see all kinds of big kettles with boiling water. And so what you do is they handed me a rifle, and it was wrapped in orange wax paper and covered with cosmoline, which is a grease. I was told to boil it and clean it. So we did. 12 of us then were loaded aboard the truck, and we were driven to the front. Snipers all the time waiting away. And then they dropped us off at a fortress in the Siegfried Line. Siegfried Line was a concrete fortress, a line of them, hundreds of them, and they're all below ground. So we finally got off the truck and made our way in, and I ended up first in the Siegfried Line. So we would go down. By that time, there were 8 of us. We lost some just walking on the road. We could hear artillery fire in the distance, and we continued on the truck, and we're told to get off and wait for the old men. The old men were fellows that had been on the line for a month. And so we went into the bunker, and there were GIs laying all over in the bunker, and the walls were covered with black soot, and water running down the sides, and you could see little fires burning, guys laying on the floor and all that. The light was made by burning composition 2 plastic explosive. And so some were cooking by that. It would be pitch dark, but they were burning plastic explosives to give off light. But it gave everybody headaches. So that's, we were just in there shortly, and a second lieutenant stood up, and he says, "Welcome to General George Patton, 90th Infantry Division, 358 Regiment. Vibrations and gunfire outside." And he says, "We just had a break in our lines, later called the Battle of Bulge." Mm-hmm. And our role was to go down the trenches to a fort, and it's just below ground level. And so as we went down there, we would see the door and a little area open. We would run up to the gate, run up to a door or doors, and we would put plastic C2 explosive on the door and blow the door off. And when we did that, we would run right into the fort then, and we would shoot anything that was holding a weapon. You have to act fast because they all are armed. You learn you have to be fast because every fort we had to break in, they were armed men in there. When I say, talk about a fort or fortress or bunkers, all the same. When I was near the end of the Siegfried Line to go into a village clearing, I was the first one through the entrance of the bunker. And about 12 feet away, I see this person. We had just blown the door. So this person was small. The uniform was too big, about 12 feet away. The helmet framed the very small face, and the eyes were looking right at me, and he was standing, getting up on one knee, and he was pointing a BRRRP automatic weapon gun right at me, and I shot him first. If I had not shot him, he was armed with a very fast automatic weapon, BRRRP gun. Then he would have killed me and all my buddies behind. So after I shot him, I ran out of the bunker.
How old do you think that young man was?
10 years old. I had no choice. Otherwise, he would have killed me and all my buddies.
But that knowledge that he'd been forced to kill a child soldier is something that haunted him for decades. When we come back, what happened 60 years later that freed Bob from recurring nightmares? 93-year-old Bob Thomas is our guest today. You can find photos of him then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, "One of these days I'm going to do something with those"? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Dr. Bob Thomas, 93 years old, of Chula Vista, California. Bob spent 40 years as an optometrist, but there was one pair of eyes he saw over and over for decades in his nightmares. The eyes of a German boy, approximately 10 years old, who had pointed a BRRRP gun at him when Bob breached the door of an enemy bunker. The 18-year-old American had no choice but to fire on him. If he hadn't, Bob and the other men behind him would have been taken out by that automatic weapon in the young boy's hands. What finally freed Bob from those incessant nightmares was a connection made at a 90th Infantry Division reunion 60 years after World War II.
Yeah, I went to a reunion, yeah. And there's Vern Smith and Tyler, and they happened to be in there at the reunion. And they interviewed me and found out that this attitude I have about nightmares. And so they took me up to a hotel room, and they introduced me to a fellow there by the name of Bruno Ehrlich. Born on the Wrong Side of the Fence is a book he did.
And so everyone understands, for 60 years after the war, you suffered from nightmares about that incident where you had no choice but to kill a young German boy.
Oh, absolutely. But I had no choice because he was pointing a burp gun at me.
How frequent and how vivid were those nightmares over the years?
You never lose them. And I looked for help from professionals, civilian and VA, and they all told me the same thing. You know, you're justified, otherwise you would have been killed. But they were not the ones that had the nightmares.
So they told you that, but that didn't cure you. You couldn't shake them.
So when Vern Smith and Tyler took me up to Bruno Ehrlich's, Bruno Ehrlich was a young child, about 10 years old, and he was a German youth. And he was killing Americans. And a black tanker, a black fellow driving a tank, he saw him as a child. And so he captured him. And Bruno was so happy that the tanker saved his life that he came to all the reunion.
So an American soldier had spared his life instead of shooting him, captured him, and basically saved his life in the process. So out of gratitude, he would come to the 90th Infantry Division reunions to show his thanks.
Vern Smith and Tyler took me up to Bruno's room. And Bruno, we both sat on the edge of the bed. And he says, Bob, he says, that 10-year-old child was not an innocent child, forcibly conscripted into service, untrained. He was a killer. He was a highly trained, committed, highly motivated killer that without hesitation he would have killed me and my seven buddies behind me.
So hearing those words from someone who really was that young boy, he was in the same shoes, he had experienced similar things, hearing it from his perspective made a difference for you?
It made all the difference in the world because I don't see an innocent child anymore.
So did your nightmares stop or did it just change the way you interpreted them?
No nightmares. Because no innocent child.
Just gone complete. You've never had another nightmare.
I think about it, but no nightmares. I can't, when you're in this Siegfried line with all those bunkers, there is no time to think, you know. You just have to rush in and shoot and move on to the next bunker, blow off the door, shoot, and that's it. I saw an article in Parade magazine years ago, and one of the items in that was that the new war veterans are having problems with shooting children. So I wrote to the editor of the Parade magazine and told him about my experience with that 10-year-old child, and I never heard from him.
Well, it sounds like they gave you a pretty valuable gift that day. Can you help us understand how significant that gift was, that what they gave you by introducing you to Bruno and allowing you to hear his perspective?
What he taught me was something that you can't find anywhere a solution. And so it's one of the life experiences things that often gets into one's life. But, you know, there were millions of fellows that were killed that, you know, they didn't have the opportunities that I've had. I feel very fortunate. I love my country very, very much. And a lot of my buddies are, most of my buddies are gone at 93. But I love the country very much. I love all the people in it. And I'm fortunate to be here.
Well, especially since you also mentioned that close call with the Screaming Mimi. But I know that wasn't the only close call. Now, you know, some people can handle a story about gunfire and artillery and grenades and bombs more than they can a story that has a little bathroom humor in it. But I read here that diarrhea saved your life. I don't think I've ever had anyone tell me that before. Can you explain for me?
Well, first of all, when you're clearing villages, there are no rations. There are no places where you can get any food. So you have to live off the land. So in the forest there, they do have real small deer. And on occasions, we would be lucky enough to shoot one. And then we carry the deer into a farmhouse. And there's nobody around. And nothing. And so here we got this deer. And so we call out. And a little man comes out. And so we talk to him, or motion, whatever we have to do it. And cook it, and you can have some of the deer. And as soon as he understands that, wow, he calls out, and all the rest of his family comes out there. Boy, before long, they skin it, cook it, and the whole thing. And that's the way it was. Otherwise, you just, in one farm, there was no animals. But they did have a lot of eggs. And so we hard-boiled a batch of eggs, and I ate one dozen of hard-boiled eggs and a jar of gooseberries. And I didn't know what gooseberries were, but delicious. Other times, whatever we could find to eat, that's what we did.
If you ate that many gooseberries, they must have gotten your system moving a little bit. And you saw an outhouse?
Yes. It was afternoon, late in the afternoon. I mean, we were clearing villages, and we decided to conk out because we were tired. And so we decided to do it to this last barn. Yep. So we went up to the barn loft. Everybody laid down and everything. And I was going to lay down, so I look out the opening of the barn lofting, and I see about 50 yards down a dry riverbed. And on the edge of the dry riverbed, right down 50 yards away, is an outhouse, little outhouse. And so, how can I say, movements is rather irregular when you're in combat like that. And so I went down there, and I went in the door. And as soon as I drop my pants, I hear this motor and the squeak of tracks. And at my time there, near the end of the war, one of the worst machines came into action, and that was the King Tiger tank. So anyway, I drop my pants, and then I was just starting to sit down, and I hear this motor, a squeak of tracks. And so I'm looking through the cracks in the outhouse, and down the dry river, I can see a tank coming, but I couldn't tell what kind of a tank it was. And so as it gets closer and closer, a King Tiger tank, just big. And our Sherman tank has about a 7-foot long barrel, and a King Tiger tank has about a 20-foot long barrel with a big bolt on the end of it that helps break some of the concussion when it's fired. So I see this tank coming towards me in the riverbed. And as it's about ready to pass me, I see this big bulge on this long barrel, and it stops right at my outhouse. And it turns and points upward to the barn loft, missing my outhouse by inches. And it starts firing. Boom, ch, boom, ch. Boom. And as soon as it passed me, then I pushed out of the outhouse and ran out. My pants were down, so I fell flat on my face. And then I got up, and I ran up and met some of the guys. And diarrhea had saved my life. No question about that.
Were there other guys still in the barn loft?
Yeah, they were all killed.
That sounds like a sobering moment.
Well, one thing George S. Patton once said, a blue-blooded American loves the sting of battle, and that combat is a magnificent experience. And that may be true, but I was an 18-year-old kid fresh out of high school. And to me, combat was fear, cold, hunger, confusion, and survival, in that order. I respected General Patton. He was an excellent tactician.
You mentioned the screaming Mimi that put you in the hospital. Can you tell me how that unfolded, what you were doing and what happened and what it felt like?
We were doing village clearing. In village clearing, there's just eight of us now. You go down the road, no trucks, no nothing. And then as you come to a village, or farmhouse, then you clear the farmhouse. And that means take the Germans away. Oftentimes when we would run into Germans, sometimes they would give up. And they did want us to send them back to their line. And so we would push them, disarm them, push them towards my line, mm-hmm. because they wanted to be with the Americans and not the Germans. So we were in village clearing, and we had to string, I think it's two guys or four guys, had to string a wire out on the hilltop so that we could report any new German troops coming. And it took a bunch of men, two or three or four, to carry the big spool of wire. And I carried a telephone. I was lucky. And so we were all out on the hilltop. We had just set up a telephone and everything. And then all of a sudden, German rockets, usually six or eight on a wheeled truck, fire six or eight rockets. And I counted, I think, two of them, and then I woke up in a evac center, which was a takeover castle, on a stretcher, which I was afraid of falling off of, laying up on a stretcher. Very nauseated, bleeding in both ears. It's just not a good deal. And so from the evac, they sent me to the hospital, and from the hospital back to a tent for convalescence. And I was in the tent later when an officer came into my tent and ordered me to ride shotgun on the back of his Harley-Davidson motorcycle.
And we heard a little bit about that earlier when Bob ended up at the salt mine at Reinsbach and even took home some souvenirs from there. There's a parallel story that Bob is very passionate about. We'll hear about that when we come back. Bob Thomas, 93 years old, of Chula Vista, California, World War II veteran of the 90th Infantry Division, is our guest today. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at my EECU.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 93-year-old Bob Thomas of Chula Vista, California. Earlier, he mentioned how he ended up in the hospital bleeding from both ears while serving with the 90th Infantry Division in World War II. It was a German rocket, nicknamed a Screaming Mimi, that detonated very close to where he was. But I don't think you told us how close, Bob. Do you have an estimate on that?
Well, it was just pretty close.
So it must have hit close enough to knock you down and knock you unconscious.
Oh, for sure. Just, yeah. Incidentally, there's so much noise when you're on the line, where all the fortresses, you know, and I have dragon's teeth. Yeah. Dragon's teeth are great pyramid-shaped concrete things about 5 feet tall. They're there to block the entry of tanks, and they do a pretty good job. We were, eight of us was in a line, we were going to go to the village away down at people from where we were getting along, a lot of fire. And I was almost next to the road to me, and I'm going down this way. We're waiting for an American tank to come by to give us support, because there's noise and artillery and everything all the time. And so, and it's dark. Rumor, you can hear whispering, and the tank is coming. Tanks are coming. And so I turn and stand on the road, and I look down, and I could see a little pinpoint of light. Some of the tanks had the pinpoint of light, and it's coming down towards us. Well, as it comes down, it passes, and I'm arm's length from me. We were expecting a Sherman tank, but it turns out to be a King Tiger tank, and with a cross on it. Mm-hmm. And so it passes me, and it stops just past me, and an officer sticks his head up. By now, it's just kind of light, and the tank stopped, and it says, "What German unit is this?" Jerry Steinhardt, one of my buddies, he says, "They're American. The woods are full of American tanks and soldiers." And as soon as he said that, clunk, and it takes off down the road towards the village. I usually was you're very close to your buddies. And to my left, when we were waiting to go, to my left and down about 3 feet, was Jerry Steinhardt. And Jerry Steinhardt was the only one that I ever ran into that could speak German. So when they called out, you know.
The German tank commander said that in German. What German unit is this? But he was able to answer him in German?
Oh, yes. The woods are full of American soldiers and tanks. Bomb. And just as it gets a weight down, then a soldier on horseback runs after the tank. And as he passes us running after the tank, some of the guys fired at the man on the horse. So as we then head down into the village, as I'm going down there, I look to my right, and there's that horse standing there, and it's got bleeding, big bullet holes on the left rear flank. The horse does, and the soldier's on the ground. And as I go by that, then Jerry Steinhall and another buddy, the German soldier that was going after the tank, was on the ground, and he had a belt buckle, "God mit uns," "God with us." And that fellow took the belt buckle, gave it to his son later.
I just can't help but think, you've talked about a few close calls here, you know, the Hitler Jugend who could have shot you if you didn't shoot him, the outhouse incident where the tank shoots where you would have been had you not gone to the outhouse.
That's right.
And now the Screaming Mimi, you know, this German rocket comes and hits close enough to you to knock you unconscious, and you wake up with bleeding from both of your ears. How do you account for your survival? And how amazing is it to you that you did survive through all those situations and more?
You know, I'm just thankful that everything happened. It's just so much happening. I had a buddy. And both of us, we had just taken a bunker, mm-hmm. And we had just taken that, and we wanted to go to the next bunker. And so we're crawling in the trench, and as I'm crawling in the trenches, dirt's falling on my helmet, right there, falling all over my helmet, and a voice from behind me says, "Bob, a sniper's shooting at your head." I crouch down there, and 50 years later, I find out at a reunion, "Did you ever find out, Bob, who told you to keep your head down?" But he uses a few expletives. And I said, "I never did, but I'm the one." It was funny. But I feel very, very fortunate. I love my country. I would do anything for it. I have loss of hearing. And even the two brand new hearing aids are not really good, but it's better than nothing. I think the thing that bothers me the most is because of the concussion. It damaged my vestibular balance system in the inner ear, which caused me to have difficulty with no balance. But I feel fine. My wheelchair is great. If I stand up with nothing, I fall over. And I have a wonderful partner. She is my eyes and ears, Shirley. I feel very lucky.
Well, and I've seen your combat infantry badge and your Bronze Star, other campaign medals that you brought home. But you brought home some other medal. Well, you didn't bring it home, but you have a pretty priceless artifact. What's the story of how you ended up with silverware from Hitler's hideout with Eva Braun's initials on it?
In 1983, I met an eyewitness to a historic military event, Howard W. Vogel and his 9/10th Mobile Anti-Aircraft Tank Battalion. He discovered and captured the last great trophy in World War II, and that was the capture of the village of Berchtesgaden, the discovery of Hitler's home, the Berghof.
So what you're talking about, here's Berchtesgaden, Hitler's hideout. There's the Eagle's Nest, which a lot of people have heard of. You're talking about the Berghof, which is also there in Berchtesgaden. But for years, credit for capturing that village was given to the 3rd Infantry Division, even by President Eisenhower and other generals.
Without any proof.
And the date given is May the 4th of 1945. But this man you met, who you got this silverware from, was there 8 days earlier. Photographs that he had taken there of things before that area was burned, because it was burned when the 3rd Infantry Division arrived.
That's right.
So he's presenting you with physical artifacts and photographic evidence, and you're saying, wait a second, we need to correct the historical record. What do you hope to see happen with that?
Well, I have documentation and photographs and notarized and about 40 audio cassette tapes. I would like to be able to establish that Howard W. Vogel in his 9/10th attached to the 101st Airborne Division was indeed the first one to the village of Berchtesgaden and first one to capture Hitler's home, the Berghof. And they did that on April 26 and 27, 1945, 8 days before the 3rd Infantry Division arrived at the Berghof on May 4th, late in the afternoon, finding the Berghof aflame and destroyed.
And this has been depicted in literature and on screen as elements of the 101st Airborne liberating Berchtesgaden, to which the 3rd Infantry Division folks have said, well, that's not true. We were there first. And so you're saying this is proof that the author, Stephen Ambrose, in his writings, and Steven Spielberg, among others, on screen, that when they give credit to the 101st Airborne, they're actually correct.
That's true, yes. And when the 3rd Infantry Division arrived on the late afternoon of the 4th of May, because the everything that the 3rd Infantry Division has is hearsay. They do not have any documentation. They do not have any photographs. They do not have anything concrete proof. And so the last greatest trophy of World War II was Howard W. Vogel's eyewitness account and documentation.
So in your mind, history has awarded that trophy to the wrong competitor.
Absolutely. And also, the 101st is a wonderful organization, and they deserve the credit.
And Howard Vogel is no longer with us, but you had the forethought to record his accounts on audio cassette, so we have that historical perspective. What would give you satisfaction? Is there someone who could acknowledge this for you, that you would feel mission accomplished? I righted a wrong. I did what I wanted to do with this information. Is there something that you're looking for?
Yeah, I've been working on this since 1983, and I had many, many, many visits to Howard, and it's just fantastic. And I feel that it's time for the 101st to get its rightful honor, and that is because I can document the 101st by its attached unit. Howard's 9/10 should be recorded as the true honor.
For the capture of Birch's Garden.
Yes.
And I'm just trying to imagine what that would look like. So if you had the Secretary of Defense, the Commanding General of the Army, or the Commander-in-Chief, the President of the United States, proclaim that the 101st, you know, with the 9/10 being that outfit attached to the 101st, that they are now credited with capturing Birch's Garden. That would be what you're looking for?
Yes, and be thankful that I'm still here to tell the story.
Even after you're gone, those tapes will tell the story. But what about that silverware? The initial Say E.B. Eva Braun, 145 pieces. What do you want to happen to that?
I have it in a vault, safety vault.
Long term, what do you hope will happen or become of it?
I would like to sell the silver and the stamp box with the stamps.
These were all taken from the Berghof before it was burned. Well, I'm sure there's so many other things that we could talk about, but I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us this story. Thank you for working so hard to make sure the right story is told. Is there something that, after all these years, you'd say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Serving my country. I thank the United States for giving me help, and I'm proud of America.
You spent 10 years, the first 10 years that the Midway was in San Diego as a museum ship, you were a volunteer docent there telling your story and the story of World War II to visitors from around the world. Why did you do that and what did you get out of it?
Well, first of all, it was an opportunity to serve the country. I think that the Navy's fellows are just fantastic, and it was another opportunity to see different experience and to help out. The USS Midway Museum in San Diego is a jewel. Every person should have the opportunity of going aboard. It teaches history, proven history, that most people don't know anything about. And defense of our country is paramount. And I'm grateful that we're working on defense.
And when it comes to Howard Vogel, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like the response of anyone you've tried to talk to about this has either been, well, he wasn't telling the truth, or maybe that happened, but it can't be proven. So it's either that happened or he's a liar, right?
Yeah, it's false. He's a true patriot, and the experiences that he went through were unique and absolutely true. I think that this truth by Howard should be made a record.
Well, now that we're aware of Vogel's claim, which Bob supports so passionately, we can spend some time investigating it. And maybe, just maybe, the pieces to the puzzle will all come together. You can learn more about all of this through the links to Bob Thomas's research and assertions at hometownheroesradio.com. We're out of time on today's program, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.